Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. And you know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
Thank you.
because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. Get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big. Because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package's going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
recently picked up and got the chance to finish in a record 2 days. I would have finished it in 1 day, but I ended up reading it before bed, and as soon as I woke up the next day, I picked it up and could not put it down. It's such a page-turner, and I am talking about the one and only Napoleon Hill's Outwitting the Devil. Now, I don't know if you guys know anything about Napoleon Hill. You probably heard of him through his best-selling books of all time, Think and Grow Rich. He also has The Law of Success. Outwitting the Devil was written in 1938, and it was not released until 2011. And when I tell you that everything in this book is still relevant till this day in 2018, it's remarkable. I mean, it's masterful. The way he writes in this book, it's one of the books that I suggest to everybody should read in their lifetime if they're looking for, you know, self-improvement, if they're, you know, in a crossroads in life. It says it on the title, it's The Secrets to Freedom and Success, and honestly, it does that and even more. It's one of the greatest books that I've read, and I've read pretty much a lot of books, but I really suggest this book to every single person. So one of the things that I want to talk about that was brought up a lot in this book is fear. Now, fear is brought up so much in this book that it just makes you question it altogether. Do I even need it? Why are we doing this? What is fear? Why? What is that? What's going on when I feel fearful? And the way this book explains it, and the way that this book puts it in ways where it's like, oh my gosh, it's eye-opening. It's a breath of fresh air. I mean, if you read this book, it's hard that you would not change your life. It's truly amazing, and Hill did a great job in writing this, and I'm so grateful that it was released, and it's honestly a gift. It really is. So about fear, if we break down fear, if we want to talk a little more about fear and understand, you know, what it is exactly. Now, fear is an emotion, and what are emotions? Essentially, every emotion is energy. So fear is an energy. And who controls this energy? Who allows this energy to live? The person who's fearful is the person who actually allows fear into their lives. So when you think about it and you really examine what fear is and how to get over it, the best way that I find to get over fear and to be less fearful is knowledge. If you put it in terms in everyday life, say somebody jumped out of the bushes and tried to scare you, you would probably jump up and say, ah, and scream and run away or whatever you do if somebody, you know, jumped up and tried to scare you. But think of it like this. If you knew somebody was there and you knew that they were going to jump up and try to scare you, when they do it, would you be fearful? Would you say, ah, and run away? Would you actually be scared? Or would you be like, I knew you were going to do that? 9 times out of 10, you would not react in a fearful way. You would be like, I know that was going to happen. You would go on in your merry way. So what changes your fear is knowledge. So that to me is eye-opening enough. Once you know what you're fearful of and that you're the one who's actually making yourself scared of it because it's just energy, you don't have to be fearful of anything in this world because essentially you're in control of all of your emotions. And if you choose to be fearful, it is only your choice. So a way so you can choose to not be fearful is to give yourself knowledge. And giving yourself the knowledge in all the things that scare you, that make you fearful, that make you feel, you know, nervous, fill yourself with knowledge in that. Don't shy away from it. Attack it. Make it so it becomes your bitch. I mean, I don't want to swear, but essentially, you need to. You need to make sure that everything in this life cannot control you. You have to be in control of your destiny. So many people, you know, stop themselves from going after their dreams or becoming entrepreneurs or doing anything in life because they're scared. They're scared of what others would say. They're scared of what that it might not work. They're scared. They're scared. They're scared. But if they gave themselves the knowledge of what they were trying to do, of what they're scared of, and really, you know, took in that knowledge, the fear would be gone. They would be fearless in that area in their lives. And if we continue to tackle all those fearful areas in our lives with knowledge, I mean, we got our power. We right there, we got our power. And that is all that it is about, because the more power that you're able to harness, the more that you can do in this beautiful life that we live. So I really got a lot of great insight about myself and everything that I feel like humans want to know. And it's packaged so well in this book, and I really hope that everybody gets the chance to go pick it up. You can get it on Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble. You can do whatever you got to do to pick it up. It is my number one recommendation this month to go and read Outwitting the Devil by Napoleon Hill, because it is definitely a page-turner, and you're going to learn so much from it, I promise you. So I hope you guys enjoyed this video. Please leave a comment down below if you want to talk about fear, or if you want to talk about the book, if you read it already, or you're going to pick it up and you just started reading it, let's talk about it, because there's so much we could talk about in this one book, and I'm so excited to open up the dialogue, because I'm fascinated by it. I'm going to read it again and pick up all the stuff that I probably missed, and just excited to hear what you guys have to say, and excited for you guys to pick it up and read it and, you know, gain that knowledge and gain that your power back, because that is what matters the most in this life. So I hope you guys enjoyed the video, and I'll see you in the next. Bye.
All right, today we want to talk about Moses Dixon, and we're going to come back. Well, first we're going to do Free Frank McWhorter. Free Frank McWhorter was the first, to my knowledge, black person, former slave, started out life as a former slave, bought his freedom, and the first black person to found a township here in what we now call the United States. And then after we play Frank McWhorter, we're going to come back and speak on Moses Dixon.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
We're located at a site called New Philadelphia. New Philadelphia was founded by Frank McWhorter in 1836. The town no longer exists today. If you look behind me, there's lots of prairie grass behind me. And we're here with the National Science Foundation grant to rediscover New Philadelphia.
New Philadelphia is just remarkably significant in that it was founded by Free Frank McWhorter, who had purchased himself out of slavery, came here, planned this town in advance, legally founded it, and then it grew as a multiracial town in a region that was filled with racial strife. His mother was West African. His father was likely George McWhorter, a Scots-Irish planter, who was also his owner. And he's born in 1777 in South Carolina. In his 20s and 30s, moves with George McWhorter to Kentucky, where George McWhorter was setting up a new plantation in that area.
He was the son of his owner, and actually had a managerial role on the farm in Kentucky, and was able to hire himself out to mine saltpeter, and then eventually to become a landowner himself.
He sees the developing Illinois frontier and the availability of land. He has purchased the freedom for his wife, his own freedom. He has a few grown children. And in about the 1820s, He begins to focus on purchasing land here in Illinois and now moving his family to Illinois.
What he wanted to do was to create a town, and he divided it up into 144 lots, and he began to sell lots in this town. And from the proceeds of selling that land, he was able to purchase members of his family out of slavery.
You know, it's just incredible. A man who spent 40 years working and very, very hard and saving every penny, being very frugal, being very clever.
In his lifetime, he purchases the freedom of 16 members of his entire family out of bondage. For a cash outlay in the currency of that day, it was about $14,000 in 19th century funds. If you calculate that for today, he was able to accumulate and expend over $300,000 to purchase 16 members of his family. So it's both a story of incredible freedom and his ability to overcome the adversity of slavery, but then also just a brilliant man. He saw the opportunities of starting a mining operation at one point that helped in that process. He saw the opportunity of moving to Illinois and new land and settlement and coming here in Pike County, Illinois, where he had moved.
New Philadelphia grew slowly. In 1855, there were about 58 people here. In 1865, there were about 160 people here.
This population peaks in the census records in 1865 with about 160 residents, 30 households, several merchants. There was a cabinet maker, two shoemakers, blacksmiths, a wainwright, a wheelwright. There was a Baptist preacher in town.
What's interesting about New Philadelphia to me is that during the course of its history, it was a biracial town. That maybe 30 to 35% of the people were classified as African Americans and the rest were classified as white during the town's history. And so while there was a hierarchy based on race out here, there tended to be more cooperation and barn building and helping each other out. People had to survive and they had to work with each other to survive. And that's one of the reasons why I think there was less tension here than other places.
We've never found a record of any major turmoil or problems, and the blacks and whites lived here together peacefully before the Civil War, 20 miles from Missouri, which was a slave state. They helped each, I mean, they lived together, they worshiped together, they intermarried. So I think it's something we can all learn a lesson from.
To call it New Philadelphia, we've always assumed that it was the new city of brotherly love. I mean, that's what the family tradition is, that it was a conscious decision to say that we want to rebuild America anew, right up next to slavery. And white people came and lived here. So it apparently, for some time, it worked.
And I suspect the European Americans who moved here were of like mind. I think the story and the intent of the founder and also of the residents here would have been known by word of mouth. So that you probably had a town of individuals who were comfortable with that notion of a multiracial community. They probably realized the risks of it, and they knew the tensions going on surrounding them. This was an area completely rife with racial strife. Elijah Lovejoy is shot dead 50 miles south of here in the 1830s. He's an abolitionist and has his own printing press, and he's shot dead as a mob is burning down his house in the printing press. A town called Griggsville is just only about 10 miles from New Philadelphia. There's race riots there in the 1830s, 1840s. So this is by no means a frontier area free of racial strife, and yet he's able to accomplish all these remarkable features of creating an integrated town that is good purposefully and explicitly to obtain funds to buy his family freedom.
We're fairly certain that an abolitionist community of free black people who were actively getting their families out of Missouri and Kentucky to come and live here would not have been something that would be unknown to the abolitionist Underground Railroad network.
Everybody knew when you got to New Philadelphia, you had a pair of shoes and a horse and directions or a guide to get you to Canada, which, you know, that's a wonderful story. Frank made such a wonderful contribution to the whole notion of freedom.
It's very hard for archaeologists to find the actual material remains of the Underground Railroad because it's basically individuals escaping, staying in known structures that are used as a barn. It's not as if you create special spaces for it. But there's a tremendous oral history and then documentary history of the area that gives us every reason to believe that New Philadelphia was an active participant in the Underground Railroad.
after the American Civil War, there's also a migration from the South where we see a lot of African Americans moving into Illinois and Hadley Township and also into New Philadelphia. And that's probably the reason why the town's population peaked in 1865.
In 1869, the town's bypassed by the railroad and the population begins to decline. So that by 1885, we see in the court records that part of the town was declassified as a town and the land reverted for general agricultural use because people had moved away and now it was basically being pulled back into general farming use. We're exploring the reasons for the bypass of the town by the railroad, and we have not yet found any of the traditional reasons of topography made a reason to avoid the town. And it may be that that fits within the, we're going to find that that fits within the story of racial impacts, that there may have been some sort of racial bias of the actual route of the railroad, and that's an ongoing research question for us.
The early settlers dug a cellar hole, they built a cabin around it, and after the town was abandoned, they'd start filling it with trash. And the trash is what we're after. We're interested in other people's garbage because that gives us a clue about what people are buying, what they're consuming, their access to markets, their dietary habits.
The more households we can excavate, compare the data, compare the material culture, the building styles that we can infer of architecture, the richer picture we'll have of the history of the town.
We've been here about 4 weeks now. We found a lot of glass, just flat glass and ceramic. And then in the past couple of days, we found a key. So that was a really cool find.
We just found a small cylindrical piece that could be a game piece or a doll over by where Jason and Hillary are working.
And we've also found there's, you can't see it anymore, but there used to be like some ash. And so one idea that we have is that it might have been like a fireplace. We've been finding a lot of burned bones and a lot of animal bones over in this area over here. And that's really where we found the majority of our artifacts.
And once the artifacts are washed and sorted out in the field, we bring them in here in drying trays to dry. And then we put them in artifact bags and take them to the museum where we'll catalog them. There's porcelain feet. We think they're from a doll. We found some other fragments. We haven't tried to put them all together yet.
The last couple of days, we'll be filling everything back in, which is kind of sad, but, you know, we have to do it, be as non-destructive as possible. And then we're all moving to Springfield, to the Illinois State Museum Research and Collections Department, where we will be analyzing all of the artifacts we've been pulling out and hopefully getting a clearer picture of what it is that happened here.
I love it. I think it's fascinating. It's part of history, and we can learn something new from them. Every little piece they take out, we can learn something.
It's good to see the community also so interested in a project like this. It just makes you feel that Free Frank actually did, not only did he inspire others around him, I'm sure, during his time, but for years to come, his story is still going to live on, and through us finding artifacts and researching and hopefully displaying some of them, people who may not have known about the story may learn and get something from it.
It's almost that this is a cross-section of America. You have just tons of people living here, and it's probably not a racial utopia. People are probably terribly harmonious. There's conflict here, and days are tough, and breaking the sod is still as hard here in New Philadelphia as it is anywhere else. But this is a whole slice, a cross-section of America at large, taken down to about 40-some acres. And so understanding this little place helps us to build a broader picture of what America could be.
It's just such a great story. You feel like you're really learning something about one of the untold American heroes.
He negotiated and purchased the freedom of himself, his wife, other kids. He came here and assisted the Underground Railroad. And he sent descendants to fight in the Civil War. So it seems to me, Frank and his family fought for freedom every way you could.
His gravesite, as a matter of fact, is one of three in the state. It's on the National Registry of Historic Places, Abraham Lincoln, and then Douglas, the senator that he debated. And the third is Frank McWhirter. So he's certainly a part of the memory in the state. I think he's in a good place. He's in a very good place.
He's just a phenomenal individual who should be in every history book that you know students are reading in our grade schools, in our primary schools. He should be there when you read about, you know, Abraham Lincoln. It's individuals like Free Frank who should be part of the story too.
Well, I think the main thing is we can learn is that America is possible. The country is possible. I think that's the message. America is possible. That's the message of Free Frank.
And be very specific about what you're talking about in the process. Get away from the slogans. Go in, if I'm talking to anybody who's a politician, go in with a list of things, always. Just don't go in with abstractions and say, well, we black people would like to have our freedom. We'd like to have better neighborhoods. We'd like to have better schools. These are titles. That's an excellent start. But you have to be specific. In my school, I want this to be taught. So that when I walk out of that school with a piece of paper in my hand saying that I have graduated, I want to know exactly what I'm going to be doing with at least this first part of my existence. What are the opportunities available to me where I can walk in a door and present my diploma, my degree, and say, this is what I have learned, and I understand that in this place where I am now, I can use what I have learned in this place where they have sent me as of this morning, because I was in that university day before yesterday. I took a day off to rest. Now I'm coming in ready to go to work in this place because this is the place where I can use what they taught me in that university down the street. And I'm in this place where I knew that this is the place that I was going to come to so I can make money to take care of all the things that I am required to take care of in a constructive manner. I can gain that money here by giving my services to this facility because I knew about this facility before I ever left that university because that's the kind of university it is. It doesn't teach you just a whole bunch of stuff and tell you to go out into the world and change it, and you don't have an idea of how to even get started anywhere. Not a name, not a phone number, not an address, not an idea of where you can use USE, what you have been taught.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
然后工作上面我们是有一点的话就有关系嘛。
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yuba in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Li is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Li's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Li's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Li's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Li's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yuba. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low.
This is
Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.
Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend $400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's bartesian.com/cocktail.
Top reasons your career wants you to move to Ohio. So many amazing growth opportunities, high-paying jobs in technology, advanced manufacturing, engineering, life sciences, and more. You'll soar to new heights, just like the Wright brothers, John Glenn, even Neil Armstrong. Their careers all took off in Ohio, and yours can too. A job that can take you further, and a place you can't wait to come home to. Have it all in the heart of it all. Launch your search at callohiohome.com.